My name is Toby Dodge, and I teach here in the International Relations Department. But much more importantly, and certainly much more interestingly, I'm pleased to welcome here Dr. James Strong, Professor Juliette Carbo, and Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman. James is a fellow in foreign policy analysis at LSE, where he received his PhD quite a few years ago now. His research interests encompass constructivist and neoclassical realist approaches to understanding foreign policy and US and UK foreign policy and the war on terror, and also some really interesting work on parliamentary oversight of the ability of the Prime Minister to declare war. And he is, as you know, the author of Public Opinion, Legitimacy, and Tony Blair's War in Iraq. Juliette Carbo is a professor of foreign policy at the University of Edinburgh. Her research ranges across foreign policy analysis, including constructivist and cognitive, much more interestingly, theoretical approaches, and work looking at Dutch, German, Israeli, Japanese, Turkish, UK, and US foreign policy. Her notable publications include Coalition Politics and Cabinet Decision Making, and Domestic Role Contestation in Foreign Policy and International Relations. Lawrence Friedman, just walked across the road, is the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College. It's another place you can study IR in London if you want to. his research ranges across contemporary strategic defence foreign policy issues. His notable publications, and there is a long and enviable list, include The Official History of the Falklands Campaign, and as you just noticed, I had it on my shelves, the excellent Strategy of History that came out in 2013. Now, that would be enough, but as we all know, between 2009 and 2016, he served as a member of the United Kingdom's official Iraq inquiry, the Chilcot inquiry, most of us in the room have read some of it, and I think it's a superb scholarly resource that will be that I'll be returning to more and more. But the evening, I think, is James's, because we're here to recognise, to launch, and for all of you as you leave to buy Public Opinion, Legitimacy, and Tony Blair's War in Iraq. And I think I've read it in draft. I read it when it was a PhD thesis, and it's a superb book. As Laurie knows, this is an incredibly controversial topic, which makes people very angry, probably justifiably. But what James has done, I think, is a testament to his skill as an academic. He's mined very well multiple sources with a kind of forensic and dispassionate, but also a very good use of English. I think we'll celebrate that. James will speak for about half an hour, and he'll convince you what a wonderful book it is and why you should buy it. And then Juliet, about 10 minutes, Laurie for about 10 minutes, then we'll throw it open to discussion. So without further ado, let's welcome James Strong.
Thank you very much, everyone. Democracies are not supposed to fight unpopular wars, but Britain did exactly that when it invaded Iraq in March 2003. Professional politicians are not supposed to court career disaster by leading their countries into conflicts that people do not want. But Tony Blair did exactly that. He ignored hostile opinion polls. He ignored critical media commentary. He ignored both the largest parliamentary rebellion and the largest street protest against any government ever. In this book, I ask how it was possible that Britain wound up fighting a war in Iraq that so many British people considered illegitimate. It's a complicated question. I begin by asking why public opposition failed to prevent the invasion, and show how, from a foreign policy analysis perspective, it wasn't that surprising. I then consider how the arguments ministers made in the pre-invasion period constituted the legitimacy deficit that followed. Finally, I look at the causes and consequences and the implications of what I believe deserves very much to be remembered as Tony Blair's war. Okay, so in the first part of the book, I present what I call a holistic account of British public opinion towards the prospect of war in Iraq between January 2002 and March 2003. My holistic approach combines traditional survey methods in the form of opinion polls with an original content analysis of some 2,150 newspaper comment pieces, 333 parliamentary speeches, a range of participant accounts, and the treasure trove of detail and documentation released by the Chilcot Report. Thank you very much, Sir Lawrence, for your role in that. I assume we can take the report as read and we'll just move on. I argue that this holistic approach better reflects the goals of a foreign policy analysis study. As a foreign policy analyst, I'm not really that interested in what public opinion objectively is. That doesn't really matter that much to me. What I'm interested in is what version of public opinion winds up influencing policy making and why. And what I argue is that this combination of polling, media commentary, and parliamentary debate better reflects the way policymakers view the political environment around them. And I also argue that it helps compensate for some of the shortcomings of traditional opinion polling methods. Echoing critical analyses by figures like Herbert Blumer and Pierre Bourdieu, I argue that opinion polls unreasonably assume that every citizen has a view on every foreign policy opinion. I don't think that's true. They weigh every individual's opinion equally, as if every individual was equally important. I don't think that's true either. And they reflect particularly the concerns of those elites who have the power and the wealth to commission opinion polls in the first place. Journalists looking to write headlines or politicians looking to get elected. I argue that actually the latent views of the passive mass public don't really matter most of the time. It doesn't really matter what ordinary people think about these kind of issues. It matters if it's going to affect how they're going to vote, and public foreign policy usually doesn't shape how people vote. It matters if you're going to have a referendum, although I think we've established now we probably shouldn't do that anymore. Now, I do still use opinion polls. I use them because they both reflect and shape elite discourse, and they affect decision makers as well. And on this first slide, I have a summary of some of the opinion polls conducted in the build-up to the war. And what's pretty clear from this is that for most of the period between early 2002 and March 2003, most British people opposed the idea of invading Iraq. But these results don't actually stop the invasion for two main reasons. First one, because in Douglas Foyle's classic terms, Tony Blair saw himself as an executor. He believed it was his job to lead rather than to follow public opinion. So he sees these polls, he's aware of them, but for him it's just a problem to be solved. It's not a cause for second thought. Secondly, and relatedly, Blair successfully predicts that public opinion would rally around the flag when it actually comes to fighting. That this is a well-established phenomenon in the literature on public opinion on war. When the troops come into battle, people don't want to look disloyal, they don't want to be accused of being saboteurs or traitors or however we're going to put it. And many people also resign themselves to the inevitable, and again, we've seen that a lot after the referendum as well. So we expect this kind of surge. Blair predicts it, and he's right. He's right that if he hangs in there, eventually public opinion will come around. By the time the troops roll across the border, opinion polls are more than 50% in favour of the war. Now, as the second slide shows, most British newspapers also predominantly opposed the invasion of Iraq. The red ones, the lower ones here, this is the majority of comment and editorial in the paper is anti-war. The green ones, the majority of comment and editorial in the paper is pro-war. Sorry if I step back a little bit, see a bit better. But the picture is actually not as negative as this slide suggests. For one thing, it combines both editorial lines and the views expressed by commentators. So you'll see the Observer here is in the anti-war camp, but actually the Observer's editorial line was pro-war. When it came down to it, they said, actually, we think this is the right thing to do. Most of the commentators disagree. More significantly, more crucially, the papers that most strongly support the invasion at this end, we've got the Sun newspaper right down this end, sold more copies than the anti-war papers. More people were buying pro-war newspapers than were buying anti-war newspapers. During this period, the Sun sold 15 times as many copies as the anti-war Independent, 9 times as many as the Guardian, 1.7 times as many as the anti-war Mirror. On average, pro-war publications sold 1.88 million copies of each edition to 1.24 million for the anti-war side. Compounding this advantage still further is the fact that these papers that are supporting the war are exactly the newspapers we would traditionally expect to be most opposed to a Labour Prime Minister. In other words, it's the people you would expect to be speaking out against a Labour government who are supporting it, and the ones you'd expect to support it who are criticising it. And that matters because it matters when we consider it alongside what happens in Parliament as well, what the parliamentary picture
looks like.
Here we see again Conservative Party MPs, opposition MPs, much more in favour of war in Iraq than government MPs, the Labour Party MPs. And what all this means is that the Blair government can afford to ignore opposition. It can afford to ignore it because when the next election rolls around, who are people going to vote for? Right, if you're a Labour voter who's annoyed about the invasion of Iraq, you can't exactly go and vote Conservative. That's not going to solve your problem. Right, we see a very similar thing happen in the US, where anti-war voters had a choice between the pro-war Republicans or the pro-war Democrats. Right, you're getting a pro-war person either way. Now, okay, you could vote Liberal Democrat, very consistently anti-war. It was slightly less unfashionable to vote Liberal Democrat in 2005 than it is today, but you've still got the problem that they were not seen as being a credible alternative government. So Blair's insulated from electoral punishment by this. What this means is that from an FPA perspective, when we consider the intervening variables as foreign policy analysts we expect to shape the influence of public opinion, the Blair government is in quite a strong position. Now what I argue is that by taking this holistic approach, we can also consider how important various different public groups consider the invasion, the issue of Iraq, to be. And on this chart, I break down the proportion of source materials that I gathered for this study that come from each month during the pre-invasion period. And what we see is three distinct spikes in interest. The first one, after President Bush described Iraq as being part of an axis of evil, and Prime Minister Blair went to visit him at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. The second one, following widespread debate in Washington over the prospect of war with Iraq during the summer of 2002, and then the release of the British government's weapons of mass destruction dossier in September. And then the third one during the UN inspection process and in the final build-up to war. In this final slide, I promise I won't need more charts. Sorry for people over that site. You can buy the book. They're in the book. They're not animated in the book. What I've done on this slide is combine data for the direction and the intensity of opinion. So these are combined measures that take into account pro-war versus anti-war opinion and the volume of commentary taking place in each month. And from this perspective, the picture doesn't look like a constant stream of opposition at all. Instead, what it looks like is a series of spikes in opposition that then go away. And what's really significant about this, from my perspective, but also I think from the perspective of the Blair government, is what seems to make these spikes go away is communication efforts from the government. So the initial spike when Tony Blair is going to visit President Bush in Crawford largely goes away when Blair says, look, we're going to support the US in challenging Iraq, but we're not going to do anything too dramatic just yet. We're not going to go to war tomorrow. And this argument largely works. It doesn't actually change anybody's mind, but it convinces them that nothing is happening imminently. The issue goes away for a while. Similarly, in the summer, what we see is a big spike in opposition driven simply by the fact that everyone in Washington is talking about this coming war, and the Blair government is on holiday. It's August, no one's there. There's nothing at all coming out of Westminster. So journalists speculate. They say, well, why are they not telling us anything? It must be because the war's about to start tomorrow. That's terrible. The war can't possibly start tomorrow. And the whole thing becomes self-generated. The government comes out and says, look, we're going to go to the UN. President Bush says we're going to go to the UN. They release the weapons of mass destruction dossier. The issue goes away for a while. But again, as you see, not to quite such a great extent. And fairly quickly, it comes storming back. So on the one hand, this observation, I think it's quite interesting that the communication efforts the government puts out, firstly, the fact they don't actually change anybody's mind is significant. But secondly, the fact that they do seem to lower the salience of the issue, the fact that they do seem to make it go away for a while is important, not least because what happens when I turn to look at legitimacy in part two of the book. Okay, that's enough slides. Tony Blair tries to argue his way to war in Iraq. He makes set-piece speeches, he holds press conferences, he publishes information dossiers. He takes questions from MPs and from live television audiences. He leads five major House of Commons debates. He even appears on MTV, which is every bit as awkward as it sounds like. He claims he wants a full, open, well-informed public debate on the prospect of war in Iraq. He says it repeatedly, and on the surface, to some extent, he appears to act that way. All of these different communications exercises, there's a lot going on. But I argue these surface appearances are misleading. I see you sort of full of shock as I say this. In the second part of the book, I discuss how the content and the form of Blair's arguments in the pre-invasion period shaped the legitimacy deficit surrounding the war. I begin by discussing the notion of legitimacy as a discursive construct, as a product of public debate, as something that we argue about and shape through how we talk about it. Echoing debates among scholars of legitimacy between those who talk about a political definition in which something is legitimate if everyone agrees it's legitimate, and a normative definition in which it doesn't matter if everyone agrees, it's only legitimate if it follows a particular set of external rules, I established two ideal types of communicative legitimacy. One, a Habermasian form inspired by Jürgen Habermas's social theory, based on reason, based on truthfulness, openness, and willingness on the part of all participants to be persuaded. The other, which I label Foucauldian, although this critical theorist among you, I claim no particular expertise in Foucault, so please don't ask me about Foucault. I'll give you the honest answer, I have no idea. This is a much more persuasive line of argument. This is much more bludgeoning people, taking advantage of information that they don't have, shaping the debate in a way that's going to be beneficial. And I argue that actually the main driver of the legitimacy deficit surrounding the Iraq War is this disconnect itself. It is this insistence that what they are doing is having an open, well-informed, reasoned, open-ended debate, when really the key decisions have already been made, when really what they're trying to do is persuade, is trying to change people's minds. What I find is that the government generally doesn't lie outright, generally speaking doesn't lie outright, but is often economical with the truth. And I think that's a fair way of putting it. Particularly when discussing the evidence underpinning belief. So generally speaking, when ministers say they believe something, it's true, they do believe it. But what they don't say is they believe it for reasons that are not often very good. And I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. Though they have this wide range of communications exercises, the government goes to great lengths to control who actually gets to participate in them. We see key decisions taken without any discussion at cabinet. And in fact, we see Tony Blair take some key decisions without consulting with anybody, anyway, which is problematic if what you're saying is the outcome is undecided and we're going to have an open debate. And although some individuals, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw to some extent, Attorney General Lord Goldsmith most famously, some individuals are willing to reconsider their position in the face of new information, most ministers and officials stick resolutely to their established positions regardless of developments. And I go on to talk about some of the more specific shortcomings in the government's communication campaign and how they undermine its arguments. In particular, I talk about the claims that Iraq was developing weapons of mass destruction and that these threatened Britain. The claim that there were good grounds in international law for the invasion of Iraq. The claim that overthrowing Saddam was the morally proper thing to do. And the claim that the Blair government possessed sufficient political authority to make these kinds of decisions on behalf of the international community. I find each of these claims problematic. I'm not going to try and talk about all of them now. They're problematic in terms of these Habermasian criteria that I've set out, but more prosaically, they're also just not that persuasive. I'm going to begin. I'm going to talk a little bit about weapons of mass destruction first. By making clear pre-invasion statements about the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, the government both undermines its claim, its normative claim to legitimacy in Habermasian terms, and sets standards that it later struggles to meet. And there's a few reasons for this. To begin with, the government gets key judgments wrong. It gets key decisions wrong. For example, MI6 somehow, this is a great note in the Chilcot report, by the way, somehow fails to spot that one of its sources has based his description of Iraqi chemical weapons on the movie The Rock, starring Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. When it figures it out, it doesn't tell anybody. This comes to light only after the invasion. Now, it's not all like that, but there are things like that are in there. The Joint Intelligence Committee falls victim to a degree of groupthink. Now, they're not alone in this. Right? Britain's is not the only intelligence service that looks at the evidence coming out of Iraq and says, well, in the past, we've always underestimated Iraq's capabilities. So now when we see these little thin wisps suggesting it's up to something, that must be the tip of the iceberg. They must be up to something much worse than this, which had always been the case in the past. So you can see how it happens. But it doesn't really matter why it happens, because they're still wrong. And then the JIC fails to update its assessments as new information comes in. So, for example, the UN inspectors go in, they don't find any banned material. And the assessment is, well, this proves just how good Iraq is at hiding its weapons of mass destruction. And as no one even considers, maybe they're just not there. Because the judgment on that has already been made, and it doesn't get revisited. Being wrong, even if you're wrong for reasonable reasons, I wouldn't go any further than that, but reasonable reasons, it's still problematic if what you're telling people is we're having a truthful, open, honest public debate based on reason and evidence. But more damningly, ministers draw conclusions that go beyond the advice they receive. So Tony Blair writes in his foreword to the famous dossier that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction pose a current and serious threat to the UK national interest. The joint inquiry concludes that Blair did believe that, but that's not what the advice he received said. In fact, MI5 had advised Blair that Iraq lacked both the capacity and, to some extent, the intent to threaten Britain directly. Blair similarly says, I believe the assessed intelligence has established beyond doubt that Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction. And again, the joke is quite concludes, he did believe it beyond doubt. I mean, he says it himself, it's a fascinating exchange. He said, well, I did believe it beyond doubt. The problem was, it wasn't beyond doubt. He did believe it beyond doubt, but it wasn't beyond doubt. And in fact, the advice he had said that it wasn't beyond doubt. And Jack Straw sums up this issue when he gives evidence to the Chilwick inquiry. He says, look, all the little bits of information, however patchy and sporadic, they all pointed in one direction. But the problem is that, as the JIC said itself, the British intelligence on Iraq was indeed patchy and sporadic. Chilwick inquiry found that MI6 had no sources with first-hand knowledge of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capabilities or its intentions in Iraq during this period. None. Tony Blair describes the evidence as extensive, detailed, and authoritative. He seems genuinely to have believed that it was. It was not, as subsequent events prove. Finally, the weapons of mass destruction dossier itself is problematic. Again, Blair claims it's just a neutral provision of information, but right from the beginning it isn't. They've got Alistair Campbell, the government's communication advisor, advising on how to phrase things in the report. Now, Lord Hutton's inquiry in 2004, he concludes, well, this itself isn't a problem. It's an official document going out in the Prime Minister's name. Of course, the government's communication guy is going to take a look at it. And the JIC doesn't accept any suggestions that they don't think fit the intelligence. But it still causes problems, because just small things get strengthened and key caveats drop away. We've heard about this famous claim that Iraq could deploy chemical and biological weapons within 45 minutes of an order to do so. Journalists interpreted this as a claim that Iraq could attack Britain, or at least the British base in Cyprus. The JIC's assessment specifically referred to munitions, to battlefield weapons. They don't have that kind of range. It's also a completely unsurprising claim to make. We know Iraq had that stuff. They used it in the 1980s. This was not something that was unknown. This was not something that would have been surprising. So the government is not entirely truthful in presenting its position to the public. The beliefs are fine, but the caveats, the shortcomings in the evidence, that all falls away. The government's also not flexible in the face of new information. So they said it's not the ministers lying about what they believed, it's that firstly they believed things that were wrong, and secondly they failed to publicise the weaknesses in the evidence on which their beliefs relied. Now, to some extent this works for them. Critics challenge the dossier, and it doesn't really change many minds. Polls suggest only about 4% of poll respondents actually changed their position in response to the dossier. So this is for people who say, oh, we were tricked into war by the dossier. Didn't really change anybody's mind at the time. No one was really tricked into war by the dossier. In fact, it had very little effect, apart from, as I've said, making the issue go away for a while. But what it does do is set unrealistic criteria. Their government had said, look, we don't know what's going on in Iraq. We don't really know what's going on. But we don't like what we see. We're getting some information coming out that looked bad, and Iraq has a bad track record. That would have been an accurate statement of where the intelligence assessment was. The problem is, it wouldn't have justified going to war in March 2003. It wouldn't have been punished for it later, but it wouldn't have got the job done either. I'll talk a little bit about international law. An independent report famously described NATO's intervention in Kosovo as illegal but legitimate. Britain's ambassador to the UN described the invasion of Iraq as legal but of questionable legitimacy. Now, the Chilcot inquiry doesn't comment on the substantive question of whether or not the invasion of Iraq was in fact legal. It does describe the process of taking legal advice as far from satisfactory. Now, Philip Sands QC, who's a leading international lawyer, described far from satisfactory as a career-ending phrase. This is, you know, Professor Margot Light once told me off of describing something as being quite good. I said, well, I'm British, that's one of the strongest things I can possibly say. But this is far from satisfactory. This is most irregular, Minister, it can't be allowed. Part of the problem lies in the ambiguities around Security Council Resolution 1441, agreed in November 2002, that gives Iraq a final opportunity to comply. Tony Blair's concerned that if Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, is involved in the negotiation process, he's going to set conditions that are not politically negotiable, that can't be agreed at Security Council. So he just doesn't involve him, which gets the job done politically. But it does mean, and the Chilcot report concludes, when Britain votes for the UN Security Council Resolution 1441, it didn't know really what it was voting for. It didn't actually have an agreed view. One of the most astonishing things I find in the report is Jack Straw, Foreign Secretary, and Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, don't agree on what's going on and what their policy is until 1 week before the invasion. That's when they have a meeting and they get on the same page. Up until that point, they've got different ideas of what the strategy is and what they're trying to achieve. More damaging still, Blair believes that Britain should uphold international law, but he also believes that it is morally correct for powerful states to use force to overthrow regimes that are abusing human rights. And when pushed on the point that that's not in keeping with international law, he kind of fudges the issue. He kind of says, look, let's not worry too much about that. We'll just carry on as we are, and hopefully it'll all come right in the end, which is not a bad description of Tony Blair's approach to government in general, but it really lets him down in this context. So Blair's not truthful. He doesn't really talk about how much he believes in regime change. He never resolves this clash between law and morality. He tries to exclude the Attorney General from discussions that he really should have been involved in, and he repeatedly rejects advice, either legal advice or moral counsel. There's this wonderful moment in Anthony Seldon's book, Blair Unbound, where he quotes one of Blair's closest advisors saying, this is a man who, in terms of his sense of right and wrong, would value his own judgment over that of the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Cardinal of Westminster combined. Which, of course, he has to, because they all speak out against it. They all say this is morally wrong. He has to have this. And it's no wonder his Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell, describes Blair as having a messiah complex. Again, we see a little bit of that. One final little vignette I want to talk about, and then I promise I will sit down and hopefully people will say nice things about me. If not, I do know where the exits are on both sides of the stage. That's the claim that it was France that prevented an agreement at the UN towards the end of the weapons inspection period. It was all France's fault. We would have got a second resolution, but the French came along and sabotaged it. Now, this is fascinating because it violates all three of the criteria for deliberative, for discursive, for Hamasian legitimacy that I'll talk about. And yet it doesn't cause long-term damage. For most of the time, most of the things I'm talking about, the reasons why these claims don't meet these standards are also the reasons why they don't persuade people in the longer term. This is one area where that doesn't work. And Claire Short, who was the International Development Secretary at the time, calls this claim that it's all France's fault one of the big deceits of the pre-war period. And as Ambassador Greenstock told the Chilcot Inquiry, Britain never actually had the votes it needed on the Security Council. It never had the 9 votes it needed. It didn't matter if France threatened to veto or not. It didn't have the votes in the first place. But France's threat to veto, as Blair put it in a private letter to President Bush on the 11th of March 2003, provided some cover for the fact that Britain had failed to do a deal at the UN, that Blair's famous ability to cut deals had finally let him down. And what's really interesting about this is that the government continues to make this claim despite frantic French efforts to clarify Chirac's 9th of March statement that whatever the circumstances, France will vote no. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin tells Jack Straw in person that France is still open to compromise, that Chirac is not closing the door, that they can still agree a common approach. And Straw's response is fascinating because he says, well, I read the comments differently. And he's got the French Foreign Minister in front of him saying, this is what French foreign policy is, and he's saying, no, I disagree. Which must have been an interesting, again, the minutes were fascinating. The British ambassador to Paris, Sir John Holmes, writes home to London and says, our position can hardly surprise the French, nor the fact that we are using Chirac's words against him. He did say them, even if he may not have meant to express quite what we have chosen to interpret. No one in Britain suggests taking France's position seriously, and that's fascinating, because I actually think they got it spot on. They said, look, military action might be necessary, we obviously need to threaten it, otherwise Saddam won't cooperate. But we're just not there yet. We're not at the stage where it's the only possible outcome. Again, as the Chilcot report concludes, it just wasn't a last resort. It wasn't necessary yet. Maybe it would have been, but we didn't get to that point. Failing to take this argument seriously betrays a lack of flexibility. The insistence that France has shut down all room for compromise, even though French officials are saying, no, of course we still want to talk about this, that reflects a lack of truthfulness. And then finally, the government tolerates suggestions from MPs, from commentators, that actually France doesn't really deserve to have a say at all. And this suggestion is backed up by Blair's insistence that any veto would be an unreasonable veto, that somehow some Security Council members are not as important, are not as meaningful, are not as legitimate as others, that just by virtue of using the veto, France was doing something wrong. This betrays a lack of openness. Nevertheless, this argument works. It goes down fantastically in Britain. We love bashing the French. YouGov finds around 70% of British voters disagree entirely with Sherrod's stance, think it's terrible, think it's disastrous. Donald Anderson, Labour MP, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, very widely respected in Parliament, attacks France for essentially wrecking the whole UN process. And there's a series of strongly worded, shall we say, editorials in The Sun, as I said, the highest selling newspaper at the time, comparing Chirac to a cheap tart, and I don't think that's the baked kind, a worm. In fact, they refer to him as Le Worm, which is, I don't even like saying that out loud. And they contrast his arrogance and greed with Tony Blair's highest moral principles, which I feel perhaps is not how they would put it today. So I like that little vignette because it's unusual in that they've not lived up to these standards that I'm talking about, and yet it doesn't come back and punish them. Most of the time, not living up to these standards also comes back and punishes them later on. Okay, some conclusions. On the 28th of July 2002, Blair wrote to Bush, "I will be with you, whatever." Cabinet neither discussed nor even knew about this letter. And in public, Blair is still maintaining no decisions have been taken. At the end of October 2002, Blair tells the US, for planning purposes, no firm commitment, but for planning purposes, we'll give you about a division's worth of troops to do this. In public, he maintains no decisions have been taken. In mid-January 2003, Blair decides the UN inspection process is not going to work, there's going to have to be a war, and I think on the 16th of January, he formally approves the invasion plan. Cabinet is not told about this. And in public, no decisions have been taken. Now, it's true that the Blair government faces widespread and at times quite unreasonable press hostility. Those who argue that the media doesn't give Jeremy Corbyn a fair hearing, to some extent they've got a point here. Blair was a better communicator than Corbyn, but he faced the similar kind of instinctive hostility. And as I've said, the newspapers that were normally against him sold more copies than the ones that normally supported him. It's true that some cabinet ministers routinely leaked anything they heard about Iran to the nearest journalist. And it's true that a full and frank and open and well-informed public debate probably wouldn't have, the government's arguments wouldn't have survived that kind of discussion. They just weren't strong enough. But the Blair government, and Tony Blair in particular, repeatedly claimed that they want a proper, open, well-informed public deliberation. In making that claim and then failing so dramatically to meet it, they created the conditions for the legitimacy deficit that followed. It still mattered that the invasion went wrong. If everything had turned out perfectly, none of this would have been an issue. But things could have gone wrong, and the government wouldn't have been punished in quite the same way had it conducted itself differently before the war began. It hadn't made a series of inconsistent, irreconcilable, and ultimately incorrect arguments that became impossible criteria for success. So as I said at the beginning, the fact that the war movement failed to stop the war makes a good deal of sense. As a foreign policy analyst, having initially gone into this thinking it's a surprising case, it comes out as not being that surprising at all. the mechanisms we expect to intervene to stop public opinion from influencing foreign policy, they intervened. They protected the Blair government. However, the fact the invasion is widely today regarded as illegitimate makes sense too. The approach the government takes was neither properly deliberative, as it claimed it was, nor ultimately persuasive. And what we learn from all this is simple, I think. How governments talk about foreign policy matters. It influences public debate, although it does it more by raising and lowering the salience of an issue than by changing people's views. It determines both the political and the normative legitimacy of a decision, and it establishes criteria for success. The clash between deliberation and persuasion in the Blair government's case of war in Iraq explains a good part of the legitimacy deficit that surrounds it. Shortcomings in the specific arguments made explain the bulk of the rest. It would perhaps have been better not to have talked so much at all. I'm going to take my own advice there and sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this book launch and for giving me the opportunity to read this really, really fabulous piece of academic work. I want to start off by saying this book is a really good read. It's really well written and interesting to go through. Partly this is James' writing style. James writes like he talks. It's a very conversational narrative and sophisticated way of writing, so it's easy to read in that way. But it's also partly because of the case that James has chosen to focus on in this book. This is what a modern Shakespeare would use for his plays today. This has the stuff of good drama, charges of deceit, manipulation of lies, political sacrifice, resignations, suicide, indeterminism, a public versus their king, a leader who believes so strongly in himself and his moral fortitude that he ignores others, yet is strategic and adept to win the day in Parliament, see his position prevail, yet his legacy or his legitimacy, in James' terms, is tragic. From this interesting story, and James's mapping out of the complex contours and the shifting shapes in this debate, James offers us real contributions to an understanding of this case, of UK foreign policy more generally, and of foreign policy in international relations. And it is this general contribution that I'm most interested in. I'm a foreign policy theorist, so I looked for what this book means for how foreign policy is made and assessed and researched. And so I'll focus quickly on a couple of main issues, and I don't want to repeat what James has already said or give more of the book away. You need to read it. But what I want to do is make more explicit some of the aspects that I liked about the book. And the two main issues I want to focus on are the important actors in the social construction of public opinion and the importance of perceptions of process for legitimacy. And I'll end with how things might be different now, 15 years after the domestic and international debates over Iraq were happening, what different aspects of the relationship between public opinion and foreign policy we might attend to while still using James' approach. So public opinion as social fact or social construction. This approach that James has adopted is very novel in foreign policy analysis. He's looking at public opinion from a constructivist lens as a social fact. That's novel in itself, but then the link to legitimacy is also a very original contribution here. The book, in this discussion of social construction of public opinion, really displays for me two critical actors, the media and individual agents. The media is really significant here. It's all over this story, from the pockets of media support for Blair's position as James presented them, to how the issues of legality, morality, and threats are portrayed as information sources for the public, and the media's role in David Kelly's suicide. this book should really prompt us to further conceptualize how media plays a role in social construction of public opinion and its influence on foreign policy. And this is one of the conceptual implications that I wanted you to spend a little bit more time on in the conclusion. I know you have to make your choices, but because I think your analysis of the media in this case could really inform future research. I see the work right now on media and foreign policy as fairly stuck and stale, and I think what you've learned from this case could really enrich that with this connection with social construction, this approach that you've adopted here. The other big actor here is agents, and I'm happy to see this as my own work is on leaders and leader personality in international relations. And I saw the importance of agents is so great in this story that, playing devil's advocate, I wondered how much social construction was really going on here. How much of it was intersubjective? How much of it was co-constituted between the public and the leaders? To me, it was the leader's subjective understanding of the public that's important. How leaders perceive the substance, salience, and importance of public opinions. How they anticipate potential opposition. How do they understand political opposition and estimate its risk? This all comes down to leaders' understandings of the salience, the force, the consequences of public opinion and political opposition. So one agent, Blair, Tony Blair, is a critical part of this story. As James writes, understanding Britain's war in Iraq means understanding Blair. So according to James, Blair's views dominated the moral dimension of the Iraq debate. His confidence permeated decision-making and shut out opposition. His passion helped him to diminish the image of him as Bush's poodle. His personality traits made openness in communication a non-starter. His eloquence helped him win the vote in Parliament. Well, all of this resonates with what we already know about how leaders' personalities influence foreign policy. I think James takes this in a new direction, with his focus on leader personality in foreign policy and the issue of legitimacy. Perceptions are not just important at the elite level. This book really shows how they are important at the mass level as well. And here, what I found striking was the importance of perceptions of the process. Right? It seems that the public, or different parts of the public, have notions of what the appropriate process is for democratic deliberation to arrive at foreign policy. So they were reassured by Blair's communication strategy that there was more information coming or that a decision hasn't been taken yet. And the only thing that changed in U.S. public debate and public opinion over Iraq from all the intense media blitz that the Bush administration did was that the public decided that the government had made its case. It didn't convince those that still opposed the war, but it convinced those that they had gone about it in a more deliberative way. So I think much more could be done on public expectations and leaders' perceptions of these expectations, of what the process is and what should be the practice to legitimate decisions. So how things might be different now. I think, James, you were rightly justified in not including digital media in your analysis because much of it wasn't around back then. But now you couldn't do a similar study without focusing on new media and social media. And this has to be part of the social construction and leaders' responses to it. I think future studies along this approach should also consider partisanship a little bit more seriously. We need to bring partisanship, I think, in the study of foreign policy and the study of public opinion and foreign policy more to the fore. And there's an interesting fact, it was new to me that you include in the book, and it has to do with the 2005 election. You rightly, in my opinion, argue that Labour was returned to power because they didn't have another choice in terms of foreign policy. Most British voters didn't see another choice, and because they were more focused on domestic politics rather than foreign policy. But you also report that many Labour supporters, those that were most critical in the lead-up to the war, came to support the war in 2005, which is remarkable to me, given how the war was going and given the trends of the public opinion in other components and in other countries. So if partisanship is so affecting how people are viewing the policy, it's probably affecting how they're viewing legitimacy as well. And so I think this is something really worth exploring. And my final question about what could be different now is, what happens to truthfulness, which is one of your criteria for legitimacy, if we are in a post-truth era? Right? Reality may be increasingly more elastic, right? With alternative facts and different parts of the public accepting alternative facts as truth or as a normal part of the political process. I think that throws a bigger question into these criteria that you've developed here. So I'll stop here. There's a lot more to say. I had lots of notes that I just, on the train down from Edinburgh, I just kept slashing and committed to sticking to a time limit. I've raised some questions, but I think all of this should be taken in the spirit of constructing future research for those of us who are interested in foreign policy analysis. This book is already rich with conceptualization and balanced by very careful empirical investigation. Indeed, it's a fantastic book, which I recommend very highly. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well, I'll echo what Julian said about the quality of the book and the importance of the arguments. It is indeed a tragic story. I'm a historian rather than, I started off with being a political scientist, but I found it easy being a historian because I could just get on with the evidence. I think I just want to say something about Chilcot, if I may, first. I think it's compliments, I mean, both senses of the word, Chilcot, in the sense that what we didn't do in Chilcot is look at the public opinion polling. We did look at some of the parliamentary debates, but largely to see what answers Parliament was getting out of the Prime Minister and other ministers. So it really is an addition, important addition to the literature in that regard. The way Chilcot went about, the reason it took so long, is the belief that we had to be forensic. I've said elsewhere, I've never been in something which was so unburdened by high expectations. The assumption that we were about to produce a whitewash meant that we absolutely had to get out as much information and lay it on the line and allow people to judge, you know, not only use the material in scholarly and other ways, but form their own judgments if they wished, in addition to the judgments we made. And hopefully those judgments would be stronger because we had the evidence out there. And I think that's important because actually the forensic nature, which essentially is strictly chronological, it's a chronicle in some ways more than a history, does allow you to see nuances and shifts and changes. And I think one thing one has to be careful about is not to see the period from March 02 to March 03 as a piece. There are important shifts and turns. And my remarks I really want to concentrate on. The body that could most influence Blair, because in the end with the ones he depended upon, was the Parliamentary Labour Party. Straw and Prescott were very attuned to thinking within the Parliamentary Labour Party, and it was crucial and vital in one particular sense. It was because of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and as expressed in Cabinet, that they had to go through the United Nations. If Bush had ruled out a UN route, Britain would have fallen by the wayside, partly for legal reasons. It was the advice from the Attorney General, successive Attorney General, was absolutely clear on that. But it just wouldn't have got support. He would. So the UN process was a trap in some ways, a trap that we set in some ways for ourselves because of the sense of the legal requirement. It was part of also why we kept on about weapons of mass destruction, because that gave you the legal rationale. The Americans were never as bothered about that as we were. So the once we were into the United Nations, once Bush agreed with this, actually we were more committed than we would otherwise have been, because we were the ones who'd been pushing for this. The second point is the coincidence of getting into the United Nations with the publication of the dossier. Now, the important thing, I mean, the story is well told of the origins of the dossier. One has to be a bit careful. Dear Love misled, Dear Love didn't come clean with ministers. Straw and Blair didn't realise until well after the war that crucial intelligence, I mean the intelligence that Dear Love had come along to give them at a critical moment, had been withdrawn. They did have some, I mean, the Scots didn't have any decent intelligence. The intelligence on missile development was perfectly good, and that's what gave some of the other intelligence credibility. But I think if you look at the JIC reports, it would have been surprising if the Prime Minister had not taken them seriously. More importantly, you simply cannot understand his Blair strategy unless he believed this. His strategy made no sense unless he believed that the intelligence was correct, because what he was doing was setting up JIC against the Iraqi claims. I don't think that was the original intention, but that's how it turned out. His belief was that once the inspections process began, Saddam was going to be obliged either to cooperate, in which everything he said in the past would be revealed as lies, or he would not cooperate, in which case Hans Blix would be obliged to say he's not cooperating. Either of those would produce a casus belli. That was the ultimatum strategy. That was the basis of what they were trying to do. But of course, if it was the case that the Iraqis weren't lying, and they did begin to cooperate, and crucially, even before the dossier was published, the Iraqis had agreed to allow inspectors back in, in that case, he was on a much trickier basis. The assumption when this was set in motion, when he was urging Bush to go to the UN, was that Saddam wouldn't even let the inspectors back in. So this is the sort of twist that captures the map. The second point, I think, the point that leads to is the failure of Blair, and I think it's a failure that really begins in January. I mean, January 2003. I think you can make a case that the dossier was part of an argument for doing something about Saddam. I think that's how it was presented, and I think in many people's view, when people's eyes, that's largely what was. I mean, you mentioned that they decided to give a division, offer the Americans a division in October. That was very late in the game. The military were going crazy by then because they weren't being given enough time to prepare as far as they were concerned. I don't think Blair would have cared if the military had told them they couldn't send a division. The military were pressing for a division, not Blair. If the military had said, sorry, you know, we've got to deal with the fireman strike or whatever else they have to deal with at the time, we can't do it. Most of what Blair had wanted to get diplomatically, he got by the time he offered the division. That's what caused him the trouble later on, that we had land forces in, that actually wasn't essential to his strategy. But what happens in January is that the United States has decided to go to war. The crucial decision I think Blair made was not to stick with the UN process. And I think people argue about this. I think he could have done. The critical moment was when he met Bush at the end of January. And his belief, which I think Blix has got some responsibility for, that the UN process would yield what he wanted in terms of a condemnation of Saddam, which was dashed within days into February, this belief meant that he accepted a ludicrously short time to try to get his second resolution, and also absolutely exhausted himself and everybody else around him trying to get the second resolution without any help from anybody else. And the legitimacy drained away, I think, during this period. And, you know, on the French, I think, you know, part of the problem was, you're absolutely right about the way that the France was used in March, but don't underestimate the impact of Villepin's interventions in January, which polarized the Security Council quite quickly. I think if the French had tried to stay closer, Blair would have been put in more of an awkward position, but by it became Blair and Bush versus Villepin and Putin and so on, and that, I think, was not helpful within the Security Council debate. But the fact is that Blair made his choice that he had to go with the Americans, mm-hmm. and accepted a ludicrous timetable to try to get a second resolution, and it ended in all the ways you described. A final observation. I mean, Blair was in advocacy mode throughout. He's a very gifted advocate. The most gifted of the political of his generation, I think. And, you know, I've watched him quite closely a number of times. The ability to solve problems rhetorically. You think it's going to be that, as choice that. It's not a choice. We'll have them both because we're in the same sentence together. There's a amount of disbelief that developed. And, you know, he sounds persuasive when he's doing it. You think, well, actually, you can't. There are real choices to be made. To me, still, the most shocking part, when I was reading the stuff with Chuck, it wasn't surprising, but the most shocking part was the complete failure to prepare for what happened afterwards, on the American side and also on our side. And that was partly the result of their complete distraction, partly this desperate desire, which is true also with the military preparations, not to suggest you're assuming the failure of diplomacy. So the advocacy worked in a number of ways. But also because the debate was not about the dangers of occupying Iraq, but about the dangers of going to war. If you look at the debates, they're about the number of refugees, the people who would be killed in the urban fighting, shock and awe, and all that sort of stuff. You know, whereas actually, I mean, the war is bad enough, but the real problems started once Saddam had been overthrown. So my point is that it's a tragedy because of the way people, Blair in particular, got trapped by the logic of his own rhetoric. But the point about him believing it is not just that allowed him to be more persuasive, but it actually shaped his strategy. And that was always, to me, the most convincing part of the argument against the idea that the dossier was a sort of web of lies, and so it wasn't. It was deeply misleading, but not in the sense of totally fabricated, because they acted upon the assumption that that was true. And that's what got them in such a mess. Anyway, congratulations on the book. As I say, it adds, particularly in the margin stuff you saw in the graph, an area where you know, Chilcot, which is looking at what governments were doing, can't have an inquiry into British public opinion. That would be considered a good problem. But you can, and you've done it very well. So thanks very much.
We've been given a very rich diet of things to discuss and things to think about. We've got half an hour left, so I'll take a lot of questions and then give them back to James and then the wider panel. Yeah, you say you can't call my eye, right?
Okay. Ah, thank you for the talk. I just had a speed read of your book, and it's, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a summary of tools necessary to create a fervour for war. Do you think that Tony Blair was highly influenced by Margaret Thatcher's success and her management of the Falklands War, and did he use many of those ideas and think that they were going to work in his, in fact this was going to be his Falklands War moment? My name's Gerard Ozier, by the way.
Thank you. No, we'll check with you because we haven't got another question. Yes, you sir. If I may say so,
it's really British to talk about Tony Blair's war. It's really Bush's war, and more likely Donald Rumsfeld's war. The Brits were at best co-stars, along with many other countries who probably haven't been quite as taken up with did we do it all right or did it all wrong afterwards. I was doing a lot of work in Saudi Arabia and in UAE in the run-up to the war, and nearly all the senior people there were desperately hoping the Americans would go to war. As one senior Saudi said, it's frightening living down the road from a homicidal maniac. And he then listed the homicidal activities. More than a million people killed in the war he waged against Iran. Genocide, almost wiping them out completely against the Marsh Arabs, slaughtering Kurds, slaughtering Shia, killing his own Sunni people, invading Kuwait, firing rockets at Israel, rockets at Saudi Arabia. And it became clear that the oil embargo was not working. Again, talking later to some of the companies, the Swiss-based company that was supposed to be in charge of the embargo, they said that they were watching the roads and monitoring lorries going along the roads, but they'd see half a mile away in the desert clouds of sand every day as unmonitored lorries delivered, on some estimates, up to $11 to $12 billion worth of oil revenues to Saddam and his associates. A lot of money, a huge temptation, so his neighbours thought, for him to bribe nuclear scientists to get nuclear weapons. So they were very much hoping that the Americans would go in and their allies like Britain.
Thank you. Yes, you said.
As an aspiring historian myself who's interested in studying this period, I wonder if you could speak a bit to what sources are available now in studying this, as well as what sources aren't available, and what questions you think the sources that aren't yet available might answer in the future.
And one final question in this round.
I wonder to what extent a massive influence on Blair was that he desperately wanted to get nearer to George W. Bush than Ian Duncan Smith could. Because though we think now of Ian Duncan Smith as not significant, Ian was terribly close to the far right in America. And it comes over and over again that various people say that Tony would say the most important thing is to be near to the United States. And I also wonder, I can't remember exactly what it said now in Philcott, I mean, and I'm not sure what you're allowed to reveal of some things. I wonder if there was some evidence that even in December 2001, Tony was indicating to George that he might go that way, and certainly by early 2002, he was deeply committed, and that was part of the reason that he started advocating, choosing the evidence that suited his case.
Excellent. Four good ones for you, then I'll come back to you.
Tony Blair first runs for Parliament in a by-election. I can't remember the exact date, but it's about 2 weeks after the end of the Falklands War. And he loses. And Margaret Thatcher wins the 1983 election. Obviously, it's a very bad election for Labour, although a good election for Tony Blair, because that's when he's elected to Parliament. I wouldn't necessarily say these are tools to create fervour for war, because I don't think he does create fervour for war. In fact, one of my main findings is that actually it doesn't work. At times, it makes the issue go away for a while, but the only thing that works is sending the troops into battle. That's the only thing that works. And I would say that actually, it's almost the contrary, that a lot of what they did was just more damaging in the long term. They should have accepted either we're not going to win these arguments, or we're going to have to come up with a better policy. I think the Falklands memory thing, I don't know a lot about Blair's early period, but yeah, I think that made a difference. Was this really George Bush's war? Yeah, of course this is really an American war. You know, I'm interested in British foreign policy. I think the US side has been investigated in a lot of detail as well, and I think I fully accept that there are a number of forces driving this, but it's also entirely true that Britain didn't have to go. For example, George W. Bush says to Tony Blair, you don't have to do this, in the weeks before the war. Donald Rumsfeld says it publicly, we don't need the Brits, we can do it anyway, like that's not a problem. It really is an optional war for Britain. Actually, to some extent, it's more optional for Britain than it is for the US. Britain's not really facing the same kind of expectations. It's not only is it not expected at home in Britain, but of course it's actively opposed at home in Britain. Bush is in a different position. In the US, the Iraq War appears as a logical continuation of the war on terrorism in a way that it never does in the UK. I talk about that a bit more in the book, but I think that's kind of what I would say. Sources, the chocolate report's great. Oh, it's great. There's times when they take you through meeting by meeting over the course of a single day. There's references to documents. They published a stack of documents, all kinds of stuff that wouldn't normally have been released. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the media about the documentation that wasn't going to be released, like the original texts of Tony Blair's letters to President Bush. But in the end, we've got extensive citation from those, and then a whole load of other stuff, original Joint Intelligence Committee reports, internal emails, internal documentation. I would be very surprised if there's significant material that's not been released in some form, because my understanding is that the inquiry had access to everything. And I know there were some challenges with that, and I suspect there's always likely to be stuff that hasn't quite made it through for some reason. But for a contemporary history issue like this, the volume of source material available is astonishing. It's completely unprecedented. The report itself is 2.4 million words long. I had a fun conversation with my book editor, and I said, look, I need as much time as you can give me to actually read this thing, process it, and factor it in, while still trying to be the first academic book on the subject out after the publication. And I spent many happy weeks, and you know, my girlfriend is here, and I apologise now for the amount of time I spent here during the summer of last year, but I think it was worth it in the end. You're not going to get a similar resource for other kinds of periods, but if you're interested in this period, not just from the British perspective, obviously it's mostly about Britain, but if you get these wisps of what's going on elsewhere, you really won't find a better contemporary history resource anywhere. And I understand that was part of what the inquiry panel decided to do, and it's achieved it big time. In terms of getting closer to President Bush than in Duncan Smith, I mean, there's a great line from Blair, and he says this both publicly and privately. He says, it's worse than you think. I really believe this. He says, it's not just a strategic calculation. I genuinely think this is the right thing to do. And, you know, the reaction on 9/11, where he comes out and says, we will stand shoulder to shoulder with the Americans. But this is not just about politics with him. It really is. It's part of his fundamental worldview. This is the right thing for the world. This is in Britain's national interest. But this is someone who really, really thinks that what he's doing is right. And I think it goes beyond that political calculation. Of course, the fact that it's bad for Ian Duncan Smith is a great thing. But at the same time, I've also said, to some extent, I don't think Blair feels that threatened by Ian Duncan Smith. I don't think he feels that threatened by anybody politically at this stage. The December 2001 point, though, you're spot on. It's not just Blair. Again, there's discussions of it going around. And he used a phrase something like, we all know we're going to have to do something about Saddam. We just don't need it discussed too much in public until we've had a bit more of a think about what we want to do. So they're not necessarily talking about war, and actually what they're thinking about that early on is more along the lines of supporting a rebellion or something like that from within. It's not clear that the Americans are really going to go all in on Iraq. And Bush has only just made the decision to go for Afghanistan, not to go for Iraq. And there's people in the US system who are saying, on 9/11, right, this is great, let's go and hit Saddam. And Bush says, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go after Al-Qaeda. But it's clear it's in the background. And there's great stuff in the report about some of the things that are circulating. In particular, a letter from Sir John Sawyers, who later became head of MI6, had been Tony Blair's foreign policy guy, and at the time, I think, was ambassador to Egypt. where he writes a letter that basically says, we shouldn't worry about the lawyers and the peace talks. If we're going to go and get Saddam, we should go and get Saddam. And the message from number 10 is, don't say that again. Don't do it. We're not there. So I think it's more to it than political calculation. Obviously, it's good for him politically. Julie.
Just to comment on the issue of sources and use of the study, area of study, the Iraq War has been a boon to foreign policy analysis research, and there's lots of good work out there on obviously U.S. decision making with Iraq, but also it's been an important part of Japanese foreign policy. Good studies on Dutch foreign policy in the Iraq War, Danish foreign policy, Italian, Turkish foreign policy. And so a lot of this work is looking at using different kinds of sources, looking at the role of leaders, as James has said before, also the role of public opinion and the bottom line for democracy, looking across all these studies, and the role of public opinion in foreign policy is not very good, and the role of parliaments in these foreign policy. And this partly relates to the gentleman's observation about whether other countries that were also co-stars or participants have looked back at their own decision-making the way the Chilcot report has. There is one government inquiry in the Netherlands that is, I don't think their remit was as broad as Chilcot, but they have also looked back and very critically analyzed the decision-making in Dutch foreign policy. So much so that when the report was released, the coalition collapsed.
Falklands comparison. The point about the Falklands was Prime Minister Thatcher was incredibly lucky in her terms that the Navy told her that she could send a task force, because if she had, she'd probably fall as Prime Minister. So that was the key difference. This was seen at the time as a national humiliation that was rescued by the fact that you could send a task force. Legitimacy was never an issue, nor was legality, because you had Article 51 to do it. It was also a close-run thing. The point about Iraq was, actually there was never much doubt that if the war came, who would win. That wasn't the problem. It was legality and it was the aftermath. It was Bush's war. It's a question that Blair posed to the inquiry, and it's a perfectly valid one. What would have happened if Saddam had stayed? They were getting more money through the food for oil program, which was very corrupt. This was a man with lots and lots of blood on his hand. If you'd been able to do it on a human rights basis, the case would have been stronger, but I think still you would have had difficulty. While we were writing this, Syria was falling apart. So I wouldn't make any predictions about what would have happened afterwards. I think Saddam was a destabilizing factor in the region and had been for some time. The thing is that we took a decision and we became Colin Powell's line on the pottery barn. If you break it, you own it, and that's where we got into trouble. Although it's true that Rumsfeld said, we don't need you, actually they did. It's one of the, by the time we went to war, we were providing about a quarter of the frontline tanks. If Blair had lost his vote, or felt he had to resign, Britain had pulled out, the American invasion would have been delayed for some time. And I'm not even sure it would have happened. I think, you can't be that second bit. I can't be sure, but you can be pretty sure that that by the time the war came, we were actually contributing an awful lot on the ground, more than we ever anticipated Britain would do. Indeed, you see in some of the military commentary anxiety that if the Prime Minister realised this, he might try and use it as a bargaining chip, and this would embarrass them and the Americans and so on. So it's a sort of strange aspect of it. But there was, I won't comment on the IDS point, because it's been dealt with. On the US side, or sources, because there isn't a US Chilcot, there is a lot of stuff out, and there's a lot of stuff done, and you can put it together reasonably well. The senior American people refused to talk to us. Quite a few not so senior ones, a lot not so senior ones, Bremadier and so on. We talked to us, but none of the principals were taught to us. In part because, I can understand the reasons why, but they didn't. So the material that's missing in Chilcot, you have Blair's side of the conversation, but you don't always have Bush's. You may notice that we quote a lot from Alistair Campbell's diaries. Because one of the things we could do was check what he said was the sort of Bush side of the conversation against the documents. And he's not a bad diarist. So that's, and it's not always correct, but that's one reason why we sort of cited whatever we could find to make up on that gap. Last point on December 01. It's true that there's... they're largely at the sort of intelligence level discussions. But what's happened is that Blair has persuaded Bush, or been part of the effort to persuade Bush, not to make a big deal of Iraq after 9/11. But the deal is that you then look at it later. What's critical is when they start looking at it, they're thinking of it in Afghanistan terms. They're thinking of it that something similar might happen there, whereby we insert a few special forces and spooks, and you can turn a popular uprising from, say, the Kurds, or maybe the Shia, into a real challenge to the regime. What's critical is a JIC report in early 2002, which says you can't, which says that if you're going to topple this regime, you're going to need full armed force. And it's again one of these things where you sort of will the ends before you really think through the means. And even you can still see in the sort of Crawford press conference, there's still a bit ambiguity about what actually it would take. But you know, by the time you're in the spring, it's evident that if the aim is to topple Saddam, you're talking invasion.
Right, I know Lewis got to go in a few minutes, so this will be the last round of questions. Not because we've got to go, but because we're coming up to 8 o'clock as well. So everyone who wants to ask a question, put your hands high in the air so you can't complain later. Right, and I'll come from the back to the front. You, sir, the back.
Thank you very much. Dr. Strong, I was struck by a comment you made very early in your presentation, which was that if the whole Iraq war had turned out much better than we had expected, your book might not have been written. So my question is to the panel, is this in fact the case of the crime is getting caught, or rather that is in fact the legitimacy of foreign policy conferred by success, not failure, regardless of its right or wrong?
Thank you. And there's you, sir, with the blue jacket, and then you, and then you, so we'll come right down that line.
Yes, I wanted to ask Dr. Strong if he had a chance to speak with people in the Foreign Office or in the upper echelons of the military and ask them, what is the point of having specialists if no one's prepared to stand out at the risk of losing their pension when they know that something is drastically wrong, and that there's a law of unintended consequences, which we now see has Iraq as a client state of Iran, probably the worst possible consequence of the action.
What is your assessment of possibly the most influential part of the media, the BBC's position, and did comment from academics have any impact? and might more comment, perhaps in the way that many economists write joint letters to newspapers, have had any impact?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank James for a lovely talk, and having followed the project in earlier stages, having read the book, I'd recommend all of you to buy it. So that's first of all. My question really is to the panel, and I was wondering, all this volume coming from the public, it's a bit of a depressing study about democracy in the sense that there's a lot of noise, but it doesn't help a lot. And you both stated that Tony Blair was really, he really believed in what he said. So my question is, how did he react to the counterclaims? Did he think that they were simply wrong on the evidence? Did he think that he had the moral high ground and everybody else didn't? So my question is, what happened to all the sound that was coming to the public when it came to the ear of the Prime Minister? And how did he reconcile this very profound difference of views between himself and huge segments of the British public?
Margot, I'd like to also add my congratulations. Wonderful talk and wonderful comments. I have two questions. One is the 2005 elections. Did voting for Labour necessarily mean now having changed your mind and supporting the war? Or did people vote for Labour because they couldn't bring themselves to vote Tory and or waste their vote on Lib Dem, which is what I did? The second question is to Laurie. What does he mean by winning the war? Because he said there's no doubt we would win the war, but have you won the war if you can't win the peace?
And finally, Ben.
I'm Ben Barry, and I was the author of the British Army's Lessons Learned study into post-conflict operations in Iraq. Nothing in that contradicts what any of the panelists have said. But it's quite clear the ever-increasing unpopularity of the war with every casualty had enormous deleterious effects on the ability to conduct the mission, which became increasingly defensive. But my observation is that what you've described and the ebbing away of support after the invasion contaminated the popularity of Afghanistan. When America went into Iraq, it also sucked out a whole load of bandwidth and government attention from Afghanistan, but it fatally predisposed the British public to question the legitimacy of Afghanistan, and that's the double tragedy.
Right, Laurie first, because he's got to go quickly, then Juliet, and then we'll give the last word to you.
There were people who stood up, but not many. There's a long memo quote from Peter Watkins, who was Jeff Hoon's private office, in which he's gathered a lot of support for why your advisors think this is a bad idea. And I spoke to him about it quite recently. And he said, you know, I made my point. This is before the July 23rd, 2002 meeting. I saw the report of the meeting. Obviously, my points had had no influence whatsoever. So I thought, right, you know, it's my job to carry on. But I think that there is somehow the analysis in many ways was not getting through. One of the sort of big lessons that the Chilcot tried to push is the need for criticism and critical commentary. And I think it is, there wouldn't have been a Chilcot inquiry if the aftermath had gone well. As Ben says, I mean, it was the drip of casualties and the sense of futility. I think this is how we got stranded in Iraq that made all the difference. I think people would have put up with the sense that, you know, the WMD wasn't there if we'd actually been able to cope with what had happened. And so, of course, Margot, you're right. I mean, the winning the war, as the military presented it themselves to Blair, was presented in terms of winning the initial combat. The more sensible analyses, which somehow got crowded out and pushed to one side, and says you don't win unless you've sorted out the aftermath. That's where you lose. I think the military is as culpable in this as the civilians. That's where it all went wrong. Finally, on I think the Afghanistan point that Ben raised as well. It's staggering. I still find it staggering that after all of this, we went charging off into Afghanistan in 2006 on the basis of an ill-thought-out prospectus about what we were going to do. I don't see 2001. I think what happened in 2001 was unavoidable and necessary. But the way we went about our business in 2006, and again, the military's determination to rescue their reputation in some way after what was being seen as their failure in Basra, influenced policy. So, I mean, you know, this has obviously been a sort of Blair bashing occasion, and he's responsible because it is, in the end, his war. But there's a lot of other culpable people in this. It was a system failure. One of the problems is that no ministry was ever committed to the process. They went along with it, and because they weren't committed with it, they did damn all about it when they were in there. And that was part of the problem of the aftermath, the DFID and the Foreign Office and MOD. They were interested in the war, being close to the Americans and winning it. They weren't particularly interested in hanging around afterwards, yet hanging around is what they did. And with that, I apologise because I can't you can now say what you like about your comment.
Okay, I'll just take a couple of these questions because I don't want to steal too much thunder from James here. On the issue of casualties in Iraq, I think James does well to cite in the book the research on the influence of casualty rates and support for war. And that research shows across many, many different contexts and countries that the public can actually support quite a few casualties. So casualties can keep going up, but as long as there's a belief in the legitimacy of the war and the cause of the war. But these governments in Iraq had, other than the United States, all the governments that were participating had gone against a majority of the public's opinion, so they were not predisposed to see this war as legitimate, so the casualties only added to that. On the question of the 2005 election, it's not that I don't want to speak for him, but it's not that James is saying that the fact that people voted for Labour again shows that they've changed their mind on the war. There's independent evidence of public opinion that many Labour, not all Labour support, but some Labour supporters were going in the direction of supporting in 2005 when everybody else had gone in the direction of being more critical. And I just find that really, really interesting and fascinating. And this is a depressing story for democracy, and it's not unusual in terms of what we know about public opinion and foreign policy. And James and also Stephen Dyson has done good work on how Blair reasoned in his own mind this opposition that he was facing. And I think it was just he thought he was right, and he thought he had the ability, so self-confident of his ability to persuade people, and that if only he could make the moral argument, which the book talks about, he only was allowed to do that kind of in mid-February when the protests were so big, changed his rhetoric and really believed that he could convince people, and that really believed that the success of this would prove him right. And that goes back to the first question about is the crime is just in getting caught. I don't think that's what this framework is saying. I think it's saying that there are independent ways we can judge whether an argument is made legitimately and whether the process is legitimate, regardless of the outcome.
I mean, I would say it doesn't help that it goes so badly wrong. There's a line that I quote, I think Richard Eichberg, victory has many friends. If you win, people don't worry so much about the reasons why. But if you lose, they worry about it a lot. And it's linked to the casualty thing, because one of the things that makes people less concerned about casualties is the sense that you're winning. And if they think you're losing, that's when they start thinking, well, if we're losing, is it at least worth it? And in the case of the Iraq War, the answer to that is, well, no, it's not, because the whole thing was sold to us on a lie. And as Blair points out in his autobiography, these two things are mutually reinforcing. So every time there are casualties, the news stories mention that there were no weapons of mass destruction in the first place. So it becomes an ongoing thing. The drip-drip of casualties also becomes a drip-drip of reasons to reiterate, we went to war to get these weapons and the weapons weren't there, but yet soldiers are still dying. So it continues over time, it becomes self-reinforcing. On the issue of specialists, yet there are people who speak up, a few. Elizabeth Wormsdale, the Foreign Office legal advisor, who resigns on the grounds that the war is illegal. But there's also an issue where, I mean, the Foreign Office gets sidelined a lot in this process, very similar to the State Department in the US. Alistair Campbell's diary is interesting on this. After 9/11, the Foreign Office comes in and says, look, there are reasons behind this. And Campbell's furious. He's furious. He says, we can't have these people coming in and spouting this nonsense anymore. That's one particular view, but I think there is a broader sense that the people who are making the wrong arguments are just not wanted. On the sort of defence and intelligence side, it's more an issue of groupthink. It's more an issue of actually most people think this is the right thing. Most people are on the same kind of page. Again, we see this internationally as well. The German intelligence agency thought Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. The Russian intelligence agency thought Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Because that's the way the information was pointed. And because, as I said, in the past, Iraq's capabilities had been systematically underestimated at every turn. I didn't look at the BBC. I made a choice to focus on print media, so I can't comment on that. And I know it's a big gap, and I accept that. On academics... I'm aware that my colleague Professor Dodge here advised Blair personally on this, but I'm also aware that he had some sort of mad story about how there would be conflict between Sunni and Shia and the occupation would work, so that obviously wasn't taken seriously. Of course it's depressing from a democratic perspective, but there's a lot going on here. So one of the big things, one of the big moments in the story, is Blair dares his own MPs to choose Saddam over him. Right, he takes the issue to Parliament. And I've quoted the final section of his speech in detail in the book because it's brilliant. But there's this moment when he says, to put at risk all that we hold dearest, to leave Iraq to sink back into darkness, I will not be party to such a course. I will resign. Your most successful leader ever, the one who has delivered you these massive landslide electoral victories, I will be gone. Or you can just give me what I want over Saddam. And bearing in mind the war's going to happen regardless. Some MPs basically stand up and say, look, fair enough. I put my hands up. And some of them stand up and say, wow, if he's willing to make a bet out of it, what does he know that we've done? Democracy has limits because there's always power as well. And in this case, power is hugely, hugely important. 2005 elections, as Julie said, the data I use is actually from the Labour Party's own internal polls. A couple of them were leaked after the 2010 election. Ed Balls left them in his desk in the Treasury and they were leaked to the media. And actually what they show is after the election, it's people who have voted Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem, etc., were asked what they thought on a series of issues. And the Labour voters are actually pretty positive on Iraq. Retrospectively, they're much more willing to say it was a good idea. They're much more likely to say it's going well. Across the board, everybody seems to think that Tony Blair was the best choice for Prime Minister, but it's really striking, actually. The Conservative voters by this point have gone the other way. And I talk about this, and I don't want to go into too much detail because we're already over time, but the narrative by this point has moved on from was it a good idea, more to did Blair lie? And what you're saying to people is, you've just re-elected Tony Blair Prime Minister. Is he an awful, lying, terrible person who did this evil war? And people are probably not going to say yes in that situation. So it's fascinating because it does come back to partisanship. People are using their party identification as a guide to what they should think about a foreign policy issue that they maybe don't know too much about. Final little bit. I always tell my students the one inviolable rule of international relations is do not invade Afghanistan. I stand by that. Yeah, obviously the war in Iraq contaminates the war in Afghanistan. Also, you know, as Laura said, is part of the reason why we have a major war, a grand war in Afghanistan in the first place. What's really interesting is that after British troops come back from Iraq, there's a degree of reconciliation, and Afghanistan sort of gets seen more as being a good war again. The problem is by this point, you know, this is like 2010, 2011, again we've got the victory problem. Again, we've got no idea what success looks like, and you've got the famous American PowerPoint slide with 300 different things on it trying to explain why we're in Afghanistan. You just can't sustain public support in the face of casualties. You can't say simply what we're fighting for. I'll wrap up.
Well, I think this has been a superb evening. I think we've had two experts with different expertise forensically poring over James's book and quite rightly celebrating it. I think James has given a word perfect, brilliant speech which reflects the book itself, which is a masterpiece and is bound to become definitive. And I thank the audience and the questions and everything. So it just leaves us, having bathed in this wonderful feast of academic excellence, to thank our panellists and the thank you.